You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, do you enjoy listening to Kick-Ass News? Well, then become a part of what I'm doing here and help support the show by going to patreon.com/kickassnews and making a donation. Your encouragement and support is always appreciated. And now, enjoy the podcast.
And in Berkeley, California last night, the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst was abducted by two men and a girl in a bizarre kidnapping. Patricia Campbell Hearst, a 19-year-old student, was taken from her apartment, and her fiancé, Stephen Weed, was beaten and had to be hospitalized. Police and the FBI have begun an intensive investigation. Tom Pettit reports.
Patricia Hearst lived in a quiet, well-to-do section of Berkeley. The FBI and Berkeley police have no real leads in trying to find the kidnappers and their motive. All they know is that Miss Hearst was dragged away last night after two black men beat up her fiancé and a neighbor who tried to help. Her fiancé said from his hospital bed today the abductors acted like commandos. So far, there has been no ransom demand. The FBI is not ignoring the possibility that Miss Hearst was taken by some kind of organization, but they just don't know. Tom Pettit, NBC News, San Francisco.
The 1974 kidnapping of Patricia Hearst, granddaughter to the newspaper tycoon William Randolph Hearst, sent shockwaves across America at a time when the country was already on the verge of a nervous breakdown in the wake of Vietnam, Watergate, violent unrest, and a string of political assassinations. From the outset, it was billed as the crime of the decade, but no one could have predicted just how strange this story would get by the time authorities finally caught up to the teenage heiress. You might think you know all there is to know about the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst, but it turns out there's a lot more to the odd tale of the scion to one of America's biggest fortunes and the ragtag group of hippie militants who held her hostage and then turned her into one of their own. It's covered in the first book in 30 years to re-examine the case. It's called American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst, by my guest today, Jeffrey Toobin. He's a best-selling author, journalist, and lawyer who graduated from Harvard Law School, where he was classmates with Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. He's made a name for himself providing broadcast legal analysis on many high-profile cases, including the investigations and trial of Michael Jackson and O.J. Simpson, and the independent counsel's investigation of President Clinton. In 1994, Toobin broke the story in The New Yorker that the O.J. Simpson legal team planned to play the race card by accusing Mark Furman of planting evidence, and he received an Emmy Award in 2000 for his coverage of the Elian Gonzalez custody saga. In 2002, he joined CNN as their senior legal analyst, and he also serves as a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's the best-selling author of The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, for which he won the J. Anthony Lucas Book Prize, as well as his books Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, The Oath, and The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, which was made into a critically acclaimed television series for FX Network this year. His latest book, American Heiress, is in its fourth week in the top of the New York Times bestseller list And today, he'll reveal some of the things you might not have known about the Patty Hearst kidnapping, including the bizarre story of her captors, Donald DeFries and the Symbionese Liberation Army, some of the desperate measures the FBI resorted to in the effort to find her, and her strange transformation from captive to criminal. We talk about how the case influenced media coverage of breaking news events. We discuss the defense strategy offered by Hearst's celebrity attorney, F. Lee Bailey, and how that backfired, and how the Patty Hearst saga came to be synonymous with the concept of Stockholm Syndrome. Plus, I'll get Jeff's expert legal opinion on whether O.J. might soon get parole. Coming up with CNN legal analyst and best-selling author Jeffrey Toobin in just a moment. Jeffrey Toobin is a legal analyst for CNN, a staff writer for The New Yorker, and a best-selling author. His latest book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crime, and Trial of Patty Hearst. Jeff, thanks for sitting down with me.
It's great to talk to you.
Well, you'll be happy to know, Jeff, I saw Patty Hearst this past weekend, and she didn't have a machine gun in her hand, and she seemed to be doing quite well.
Where did you see her?
I was with some friends at the Langham Hotel in Pasadena, and purely by coincidence, turned out her daughter was having a wedding there. Her daughter was getting married to, I guess, the guy who runs Nerdist,
right,
Chris Hardwick.
Yes. Now, I knew she was getting married. I didn't know it was there. How interesting.
She looked good.
Gala occasion, I'm sure.
It was worthy of the Hearst family name, I'd say.
Well, That's saying a lot, because they've had a lot of luxury over the years.
Yeah, well, this book has been a fun read for me. I feel like this is one of those cases where most of us think we know this story, and everyone comes into it with some kind of a preconceived idea, whether they think she's a total victim or she's some spoiled brat rebelling against mommy and daddy. In working on this project, for you, when you tackled this subject, was there anything that came as a surprise or a revelation to you that went counter to whatever the narrative was in your mind?
Oh, lots was surprising to me. I was a kid when this happened, and I had the barest knowledge of it. You know, this is the first book I've written that was really at the border of journalism and history. All the other books I've written have been stories that I covered for The New Yorker and
right.
CNN, and then expanded into a book. This one I was starting almost from square one. And I was aware that she had obviously been kidnapped, that she was accused of bank robbery, convicted. But what I didn't know was the incredible scope of the crime she committed while she was on the run with her comrades in the Symbionese Liberation Army. You know, I knew about one bank robbery. I didn't realize there were three. I didn't realize she shot up a street in Los Angeles. I didn't realize she set off bombs. That, to me, was the major revelation of working on the book.
Yeah, and you say that the Patty Hearst kidnapping and the SLA were very much representative of the mood of the 70s, and particularly the violence and the chaos that erupted in the Bay Area around that time. So set the scene for us.
Well, that's another thing that was a tremendous surprise for me. I was aware, of course, that the 60s were a time of assassinations and protests, and I somehow had the impression that in the 70s things sort of chilled out. Well, I couldn't have been more wrong. The 70s were really a deeply ugly time in America, and especially, as you point out, in the Bay Area. Think about this. There were 1,000 bombings a year in the United States in the early and mid-70s.
Wow, just 1,000 bombings.
1,000 bombings. Now, obviously, not all of them were fatal, but some of them were. Bombings were a part of political protest in that era in a way that's just inconceivable today.
Yeah.
There were 2 skyjackings a month in the United States. Again, inconceivable. And the Bay Area was afflicted with serial killers like the Zodiac Killer, the Zebra Killer. And, you know, just popular culture took note of it. When Warner Brothers wanted to make the toughest detective in the United States and put him in the worst place in the United States. They made Dirty Harry, Clint Eastwood's right. iconic character, a San Francisco detective. I didn't remember that Dirty Harry was a San Francisco detective, but I think that's indicative of how that city was portrayed in that era.
Yeah, and born out of this was the SLA. Now, before reading this book, every time I heard the story of Patty Hearst and I heard of the Symbionese Liberation Army, I always found myself looking on a map trying to find out where Symbia is.
Well,
turns out it's a made-up thing.
Yes,
what is the SLA?
Well,
or what was the SLA?
The part of the counterculture in the 70s was this sense that the young people could find a revolutionary cadre in prisons, that they could radicalize and join forces with people they regarded as political prisoners. So there was this symbiosis between students and prisoners, okay. Particularly in this prison called Vacaville, which was near Berkeley. One of the prisoners there was a guy named Donald DeFries, and Donald DeFries came up with the idea of a Symbionese Liberation Army, which he took as a corruption of the word symbiosis. People working together.
Okay.
So it had nothing to do with any geographical location. It was a made-up word. And, you know, he called it liberation, though they didn't liberate anything or anyone. And as an army, it had at most a dozen people in it. So it was a very misleading name, but that's the origin.
Yeah, and throughout this, it seems to me like the SLA and Donald DeFries, they're kind of like the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
You know? Well, there really is a comic element to the SLA. Unfortunately, they also managed to kill two people along the way, which reduces the comic nature of what they did. But you were certainly right that everything, including the kidnapping of Patty Hearst itself, what was a bumbling enterprise with no clear goal or tactics, and they were indeed the gang that couldn't shoot straight. They shot their guns many times over the sort of 2 years of their existence. Fortunately, they only hit two people. Given the number of times they fired their guns,
so they could have killed a lot more. They were literally the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
They certainly were.
And the kidnapping idea kind of came out of the backlash from another action by the SLA that didn't really go well for them in the PR battle.
That's true. Donald DeFries wound up escaping from prison and hooked up with his friends in Berkeley. And he became obsessed with this local political figure, Marcus Foster, who was the Oakland school superintendent, really a heroic figure, an African-American from Philadelphia. But DeFries got it into his head that Foster was a sellout, and he wound up with two of his comrades assassinating Marcus Foster in cold blood in November of 1973. This alienated the SLA from virtually all of the counterculture, even radicals like the Black Panthers and the Weather Underground. There was an injection of new people after the Foster assassination from, of all places, the Indiana University Theater Program. And those people decided, you know, with this whole murder thing is not really a great idea, but maybe we should kidnap someone, and that would really make a splash in a way that was a little less alienating than another assassination.
And how did they arrive at Patty Hearst as a potential target?
Well, it was really just it was a matter of crazy coincidence. As they were plotting, there was an engagement announcement in the San Francisco Examiner, which was a Hearst paper, and Patricia Hearst's engagement was announced to Stephen Weed, who was her boyfriend, a graduate student at the University of California. And the engagement announcement said in its fourth paragraph that Patricia Hearst was an undergraduate at Berkeley. Now, one of the SLA members was working at that time as a secretary, and she knew that in that more innocent time, there was a public directory of the home addresses of every student who went to Berkeley, a big black binder. So her husband, Bill Harris, went and looked up Patricia Hearst and saw that she lived at 2603 Benvenue in Berkeley, apartment number 4. So they started staking her out, but they knew almost nothing about her except that she was a college student and that she was the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst.
Well, amazingly, against all odds, they managed to pull this off. And it seems to me that throughout most of the book, it's the Hearst family that's running the investigation, not the FBI.
Well,
I'm kind of amazed by the ineptitude there.
Well, you have to remember, again, the times. J. Edgar Hoover had just died in 1972, mm-hmm. and Hoover's idea of an FBI agent was a crew-cut college graduate in a black suit with black Cordovan shoes, and it was a group of people who were uniquely ill-suited to try to infiltrate the counterculture. I mean, imagine right. they're coming up to people in Berkeley and saying, "Well, I wish help us out with our investigation." That was why they made such little progress. It's also a factor was that the SLA, after the Foster assassination, had alienated so many other people in the counterculture. They didn't really have contacts in the mm-hmm. Weather Underground, in the Black Panthers. So their isolation actually yeah. helped them stay at large for so long.
But even still, I mean, some of these things just blew me away. The lead agent, you know, was resorting to psychics at several. And
yes.
there's this great story of, I guess there was a prisoner, I think at Vacaville, who said that he could help them find them if he could just get a furlough for a week.
Right.
And they actually went for that.
Well, not only, yes, they went for this ridiculous offer, but even crazier, they, in an effort to make sure this guy didn't escape, they gave him an injection, which they told him was a slow-acting poison, so that he had to come back and get the antidote, or else he would die. The prisoner was crafty enough to go have a nice time with some girlfriends and had absolutely no sense of where Patty Hearst was, but the prisoner was also dumb enough to believe that he actually had received this slow-acting poison, so he returned to get the supposed antidote, and he wound up going back to prison.
So all along the way, Patty Hearst is being held in a closet by her captors with the SLA. At a certain point, she turns. Can you point to any particular moment in this story that was the turning point when Patty Hearst turned from being a captive to an active participant in the SLA?
I can't point to a specific moment, but I can describe the circumstances. The SLA put her in a closet in Daly City, a blue-collar suburb of San Francisco. But in short order, they started opening the door and giving her propaganda. In particular, they assigned one of their members, a guy named Willie Wolf, who came from a background somewhat similar to Patricia's. He was the son of a physician. He'd gone to prep school. He'd gone to Berkeley. He was someone who came out of Patricia's world and spoke her language. And he actually wound up seducing her in every sense of the word. He wound up encouraging her to join with them. And she was in a uniquely vulnerable position. She was just 19 years old when she was kidnapped. She was living with Stephen Weed, but they were getting along poorly. She wanted to get out of her engagement, but she also was not getting along with her mother, who didn't approve of Stephen Weed. So she was whipsawed between these worlds. And like a lot of people in the 70s, she was looking for alternatives. And in this most bizarre circumstance, she did, in my opinion, become part of the Symbionese Liberation Army.
Yeah, and her big debut, if you will, was the Hibernia bank heist, where she's seen in the famous camera footage holding a gun and in the beret and all that.
And the camera footage is very important, because when the SLA was looking for a bank to rob, they were looking for a new technology at the time, which was a security camera. They wanted to show off their prize recruit. So when they went into the Hibernia Bank in the Sunset Section of San Francisco, they positioned Patricia precisely where they knew the camera was pointed. And it did produce these iconic photographs of Patricia and her machine gun participating in this robbery, which was a terrific success.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with author and CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin when we come back in just a moment. If you're enjoying my conversation with Jeffrey Toobin, then check out his best-selling book, American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be American Heiress by my guest today, Jeffrey Toobin, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. And technology and the media come into play at several points in this book. After the heist, they then come down to Los Angeles to hide out, and it ends in a big shootout that ends up being a watershed moment in breaking news coverage.
That's right.
What happened
there? Well, in up to the 1970s, if television wanted to cover a live event, they had to plan well in advance. They had to lay cable, and that's what they did for political conventions, for World Series games. But KNXT, which was the CBS affiliate here in Los Angeles, had purchased the first live transmission truck. In fact, it was so new that KNXT actually gave it its name, which is the minicam, which of course is now the standard issue for how most local and national news is covered. But the nine of the SLA people fled from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Three of them, Patty and Bill and Emily Harris, got separated on May 16th. But on May 17th, 1974, the remaining six of the SLA were surrounded by the SWAT team, again, a new invention of the Los Angeles police. And KNXT's cameras were covering it. What followed was the biggest gun battle in American history involving the police, where 5,000 rounds of ammunition went into this little house in South Central. 3,000 rounds of ammunition came out, and all six of the SLA people inside, including Donald DeFries and Willie Wolf, were killed by the LAPD. And as Patricia, Bill, and Emily Harris watched on live television nearby.
Yeah, and it was the biggest shootout to this day in
even
U.S.
today,
history.
Even today.
Wow. Now, she continued to go on the lam for a while, and she thought that she was going to go out in the same way, in a hail of bullets. Turned out that wasn't really the case. Well, how did she get caught?
It wasn't really the case, but it certainly was a correct warning to her. You know, in one of the reasons she was recruited to the SLA is that Willie Wolf and others told her, look, you have nothing to fear from us. You have to fear that we're going to be attacked by the cops and the FBI. After the shootout on May 17th, Patricia sees, well, you know what? They were right. The FBI did think Patricia was inside that house, and they fired away anyway. So that was part of what made her become a recruit to the SLA. That was in May of 1974. It wasn't until September of 1975, now 15 months later, that she was caught. And during that period, which is sometimes called Patty's lost year, she commits an extraordinary number of crimes with her colleagues. They rob two more banks. In one of those bank robberies, a woman is killed. They set off bombs the way a lot of radical groups did in the 70s. And it was only after the FBI gets a tip from the brother of one of the new SLA members that they manage to track her down in San Francisco when she gets arrested on September 15th, 1975.
Yeah, and she stands trial. The family hires the celebrated attorney F. Lee Bailey. He builds his whole defense around this idea that Patty Hearst was coerced into committing these crimes. You, as you've already kind of alluded to, do a pretty convincing job of picking apart the defense. What were some of the facts that refute this idea that she was coerced into all these actions?
Right. The key points were the independence of action she had during her year, the number of times she was left on her own where she could have walked away, the number of crimes she participated in. You know, she winds up falling in love with another member of the SLA, a guy named Steve Solia, and they lead this domestic existence together. They live together in San Francisco. They go hiking together in the cliffs off of the Pacific Ocean. At one point, they get stuck on a cliff, and they need to be rescued by the state police. The state police, when the state police gather her up, she doesn't say, "Oh, by the way, I'm Patty Hearst, take me home." She gives a fake name. On another time when they go hiking together, she gets a bad case of poison oak. The two of them go to a hospital to get treatment. She doesn't say, "I'm Patty Hearst, take me home." She gives a fake name because she is on the run. And then, when she finally is arrested in San Francisco, she gets booked. The way anybody gets booked, name, address, occupation, and she gives as her occupation urban gorilla, which was pretty accurate. That's how she was making a living.
But the name that she gives them is Patty Hearst. She doesn't tell them she's Tanya.
Well, she says she's also known as Tanya,
which
I think is accurate to this day.
Well, her attorney, F. Lee Bailey, although he was a celebrity lawyer, he didn't necessarily have the best track record as a defense attorney. If you could point to one thing in the trial that was his biggest mistake, what would that be?
One very clear mistake. He wanted to put her on the witness stand to talk about how terrorized she was by her kidnapping, which is an understandable motivation because it was certainly a terrifying experience. But the problem of putting her on the witness stand was opening up cross-examination. And Bailey thought that by putting her on the witness stand to talk about her kidnapping and how she was coerced into robbing the Hibernia Bank, he could get the judge to rule as off limits her other crimes while she was on the run, the other two bank robberies, shooting up a street in Los Angeles. And Bailey made the critical error of not getting a clear ruling from the judge in advance about the scope of cross-examination. So she gave her direct testimony, which was quite compelling, and about how terrifying her initial ordeal had been. But when the prosecutor got up to cross-examine and started asking about all these other crimes, the judge allowed that questioning. Bailey had no other choice at that point but to instruct Patricia to take the fifth, to refuse to answer questions in front of the jury about those other subjects. Taking the fifth in front of the jury is certainly a recipe for conviction, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what happened here.
Yeah, and it didn't go her way. She went to prison, but gradually public sentiment started to shift to Patty Hearst's side, eventually culminating in a commutation and eventual pardon even. What changed in those years?
Well, the thing that changed very shortly after her conviction was another example of California craziness in the 1970s. The Reverend Jim Jones, who led this cult called the People's Temple in San Francisco, took his followers down to Guyana in South America, and they wound up committing mass suicide together. 900 people committed suicide. It led to this huge interest in the United States in the subject of brainwashing. How could people do something that was so counter to their own interests? At precisely that moment, Jimmy Carter was considering whether to issue a commutation to Patricia Hearst. And in light of the Jonestown massacre, he said, I don't think she was in her right mind. and I'm going to give her a commutation. So instead of serving 7 years, as she was sentenced to, she only served 22 months.
Yeah, and this is where that whole idea of Stockholm Syndrome started to seep into the public consciousness.
That was actually a little later. I mean, interestingly, the Stockholm Syndrome is very much associated with her case, but the bank robbery in Stockholm, which gave the where the hostages sort of called in on behalf of the kidnappers, took place just a couple of months before the kidnapping. So it had not actually seeped into the American popular culture just yet. It's only in later years where Patty Hearst has been widely described as suffering from Stockholm Syndrome. You know, interestingly, and this is something I talk about in the book, is that, you know, brainwashing and Stockholm Syndrome are not scientific or medical terms. Those are journalistic terms. Right. And it is not true that everyone who's taken hostage identifies with their captors. It is a very, it is a mysterious and unpredictable process who might identify and who does not.
Right. If it's not technically a psychological term, then can that even be used as a defense?
Well,
because it is, it seems a lot.
Well,
nowadays, in
Patricia's trial, there were three psychiatrists who testified for the defense. There were three psychiatrists who testified for the government. And frankly, their testimony was so bewildering and confusing that they kind of canceled each other out, which I think is probably appropriate. And the jury, rather than focusing on the labels that were given to her conduct, looked at the conduct herself and saw how voluntary it was. And that's really what led to her conviction.
Your bestseller on the O.J. Simpson trial was turned into a hit miniseries this year on FX. With this particular book, I don't know whether I would make it as an action drama or a dark comedy.
Well, it certainly has elements of both.
Yeah. Is there any chance that we might see American Heiress on the screen?
Well, I am very pleased to say that the same producers and the same screenwriters who did the O.J. series are now working on adapting my book for a feature, not for a miniseries.
Terrific.
Now, you're a figure of Hollywood. You know that just because someone's writing a script doesn't mean it's going to be made.
But,
you know, I am hopeful that it will turn into a movie.
Terrific. Any ideas on casting?
You know, I don't want to get my hopes up. I have some ideas, but for the moment, I'll keep it to myself.
All right. Well, before we go, between you and me, I think enough time has passed. O.J., totally guilty, right?
Totally guilty. Okay. I mean, I didn't have to wait.
Do you have to
20
be
years? Oh my God!
As a journalist, okay.
I believe I'm not sure whether it's page 2 or page 3 of my book on the O.J. Simpson case. I make clear my view that I think O.J. Simpson was absolutely guilty of killing those two people, Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. The miniseries actually takes a somewhat different approach. They do not show a reenactment of O.J. committing the crime. They simply lay out how the trial went. Now, frankly, I believe that anyone who looks fairly at the evidence, as the miniseries did, can't conclude that O.J. is anything other than guilty, but the miniseries is not as explicit as my book.
Well, I hear that he's up for parole, I think, pretty soon. Do you think he'll get out?
It's actually a very tough call, I think, because I mean, I think O.J. should be serving life in prison for killing Ron and Nicole, but he was acquitted. I happen to think this Las Vegas case was pretty bogus prosecution. Yeah. I don't think so. If they evaluate it just on that, he might well get parole. He's also pushing 70 years old, and most people who are pushing 70, many people who are pushing 70 do wind up getting released from prison, so I don't know.
Well, once again, the book is called American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping Crimes and Trial of Patty Hearst. Jeffrey Toobin, thanks for sitting down with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Jeffrey Toobin for coming on the show. And if you enjoyed today's episode, then order his new bestseller, American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping Crimes and Trial of Patty Hearst. I'll include an Amazon link where you can order it in the show notes for this episode and on our website at kickassnewspodcast.com. Or if you'd prefer to listen to the audio version,
you can download that for free through a special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. You can frequently read Jeffrey Toobin's articles in The New Yorker and see him giving his expert legal analysis on CNN. You can also follow him on Twitter at Jeffrey Toobin or on his website at jeffreytoobin.com. That's spelled T-O-O-B-I-N. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Or if you prefer, you can set up a recurring monthly contribution at patreon.com/kickassnews. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kickass News to all your friends on your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnewspodcast.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.